Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So this week, the sources we got gave us this really panoramic, maybe a little chaotic, but a totally fascinating look into the world of hunting.
Chaotic is the perfect word for it. It's a snapshot, really.
Yeah, exactly. We didn't get one single story. We got a collection from a wild week in hunting.
And it covers everything. I mean, you've got these high-stakes international poaching stories.
Right.
Then you have intense conservation efforts in U.S. national parks.
And then it drills right down to, you know, basic gear safety and the loyalty of a hunting dog.
It's all over the place.
It is. It's a messy collection, but a necessary one. So our mission today is to be, well, surgical. We're going to pull out the most surprising and relevant nuggets from this blog roundup.
And we're really focusing on how these different pieces connect. You have national economics, you have ethical conservation, and then the actual, you know, lifestyle of the hunter.
Right, because these sources show that hunting isn't just a sport anymore. It's not just a tradition.
No, it's a global multi-layered business. It's so deeply woven into national conservation policy.
Yeah.
Sometimes for the better, and sometimes, well, to its detriment. We need to see how these different motivations all intersect.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start big. The global business of wildlife.
Right. So when we look at the money side of things, the sources give us this really powerful, almost painful contrast between two completely different approaches.
Two models for using wildlife populations.
Exactly. One is driven by just sheer urgent national need for cash, for foreign currency.
And the other?
The other is driven by pure resource management.
Okay, let's start with that national desperation. The sources say Zimbabwe is selling the rights to shoot as many as 500 elephants. That number, It just sounds enormous. And it immediately raises red flags for anyone who isn't, you know, deep in this world.
It does. It sounds immense. But the sources frame this as an economic recovery tool. You have to remember the context here.
Okay.
Zimbabwe is one of those African nations where the economy really depends heavily on tourism and hunting revenue.
And the pandemic shut all that down.
It completely wiped it out. They lost nearly all of that income.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing now is the government using these large established wildlife quotas as a direct financial instrument. It's a revenue offset, really, to try and stabilize their budget after a massive shock.
So the whole conversation changes. It's not just, are there too many elephants?
No.
It's, can this population sustainably generate the money we need to keep, you know, essential national services running? It's a really high stakes, almost tragic calculation.
It is. And it shows you how in places where that conservation funding isn't just guaranteed from international sources, the sale of hunting permits becomes the main way they can even maintain their whole wildlife management system.
If that money dries up,
the whole thing collapses. The anti-poaching units, the wildlife censuses, habitat protection, all of it. It forces these nations into a really difficult spot where immediate financial need dictates their policy.
Okay, so now let's flip that completely. Let's go to the United States, where the mechanism is the total opposite of revenue generation.
But the tool is the same.
The tool is the same.
Hunting.
Right. So here you have the National Park Service, the NPS.
The federal agency that runs the parks.
Yep. And they're working with Arizona Game and Fish. And what they're doing is seeking skilled volunteers, specifically experienced hunters, for a historic bison call in the Grand Canyon this fall.
And this is the perfect contract, right? In Zimbabwe, the goal is revenue. Quotas are sold for a premium. In the Grand Canyon, the goal is resource management.
Purely. The bisons are overgrazing the North Rim. It's becoming a real problem.
And so they're asking for free, voluntary labor. This is the question I keep coming back to.
Mm-hmm.
Why does a huge federal park with all the funding of the U.S. government rely on specialized volunteers for this? Why not just hire people?
That's an excellent question, and the distinction is so important. When the NPS does something like this, especially in a place as high profile and sensitive as the Grand Canyon, they need absolute precision.
And safety and expertise. Contractors.
Mm-hmm.
They might give you volume, but the specific logistics here, they demand people who are not just expert shots.
Mm.
They need people who can work safely and effectively in really rugged backcountry terrain under very, very restrictive conditions.
So it's not just about pulling a trigger. It's about tracking, navigating, following these incredibly strict protocols.
And even handling the ethical sensitivities of the operation itself.
The skills that are just foundational to an experienced, dedicated hunter.
Exactly. The NPS is tapping into a skill set that the hunting community already has. It saves taxpayers a ton of money, and it ensures the job gets done to the highest standard of conservation.
And when you put those two stories side by side, a nation selling permits for desperate revenue and our own National Park Service seeking volunteers for crucial conservation, it just perfectly captures the dual role hunting plays today.
It's complex.
And behind all of it, whether it's a huge elephant permit or a volunteer bison call, there's this vast commercial support system. The source has only touched on it briefly, but it's telling.
It really is. It's a whole economic ecosystem. It's not just about guns and ammo.
No.
You see these specialized financial products, right? Yep. Specific kinds of insurance. Hunting lease insurance. Guides and outfitters insurance.
Even vacant land insurance for just managing acreage.
Right. And the fact that those insurance types even exist tells you everything.
I think that's the real business insight. The need for, say, hunting lease insurance. It signals that the liability of just having people on your land for these activities is enormous. It shows you the financial scale and the legal complexity of it all.
Absolutely. The money is flowing, and it's mostly about managing risk to the environment and risk to people. And that flow of money, whether it's for a permit or for liability coverage, that so often dictates where the ethical lines get drawn.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. When we talk about those ethical lines, especially when they cross with, you know, high status.
We pivot hard here from systems trying to do the right thing to an individual, allegedly, completely circumventing the rules.
We find out about a Liechtenstein prince. He's suspected of illegally trophy hunting a giant brown bear in Romania.
Right.
And the source material's reaction to this was almost as good as the story. The author is just surprised that Europe has a problem with famous people poaching, too.
And the aside about not even being sure Liechtenstein was a country.
I am not totally sure that I knew Liechtenstein was a country.
It's funny, but it makes a serious point.
It does. The spotlight is always so much harsher on famous people, especially royalty, when they hunt. Romania has incredibly strict laws about their brown bear population. So any violation, especially one involving a huge animal like that, it just instantly becomes a global story about arrogance and, you know, compliance.
It feels like the scrutiny is just magnified 1,000 times.
Well, this raises an important question, right? When someone with high status and a lot of money allegedly breaks local hunting laws, the damage isn't just to that one animal.
It's to the public trust. Exactly. The public trust in the entire idea of regulated hunting. It puts pressure on governments to prove that the rules apply to everyone, no matter your title or how much money you have. The ethical lines are supposed to be rigid, but they are constantly being tested.
That's a perfect transition, actually. It takes us away from these huge global things, the bison cullers and royal poachers, and brings us right back to the personal foundational core of a hunter's life.
To the partners, the action, and the gear.
The human element, that intimate experience you have in the field, that's where it all starts.
And nothing defines that experience more than the partnership between a hunter and their dog.
Yeah, the sources gave us this list, the 21 best hunting dog breeds ever, but it was the language they used that was so revealing.
It wasn't just an inventory.
No, yeah. Not at all. They were praised as the most loyal and loving and hardest working hunting partners. And for you, the listener, understanding what those 21 breeds do, whether they're flushing birds, retrieving ducks, or trailing, that's just essential knowledge. It's so foundational to the sport.
And that intense partnership, it's tested in those moments of adrenaline-fueled action. The sources definitely captured that feeling. They highlighted a video of an intense bow hunt for turkeys.
And the detail was what mattered. A gobbler at 5 steps on a public land bow hunt.
Wow.
That closeness, the stealth you need, and just the sheer volume of noise a huge gobbler makes at 5 steps, that communicates the thrill of the hunt in a way words can't.
It's an immediate reminder that bow hunting, especially on public land, takes so much patience and nerve.
But all that action and relying on the sophisticated gear brings us right to a topic you can't ignore. Safety.
It's non-negotiable.
Yeah, and the sources included this dramatic, honestly terrifying safety video called My 50 Cal Exploded. They called it a must-watch.
It sounds horrifying, but it's an essential lesson, especially for an audience that knows their way around this stuff. When you deal with high-caliber weapons like a 50 cal muzzleloader or a rifle, the consequences of a failure are just catastrophic.
And the fact that a video like that gets so popular shows that the community is focused on diligence.
It does. From a technical standpoint, a video like that is a must watch because it demonstrates the immense energy you're containing in that chamber.
So what typically goes wrong?
Failures like that usually come down to one of two things. Either a bore obstruction, a piece of a cleaning patch left in the barrel, snow, mud.
Which turns the barrel into a grenade.
Instantly. Or it's operator error, usually an overcharged hand-loaded round. Seeing that danger just reinforces the absolute need for rigorous maintenance and precise reloading. It's a sobering reminder
that you have to respect the physics of your equipment.
Mm-hmm. And finally, to pull back from the human element just for a second, the sources gave us this one small, beautiful counterpoint, a reminder of the wilderness's own constant cycle.
Right. The video shared for Mother's Day showing a mother mountain goat protect her baby from snow leopard hunting.
It's the ultimate grounding moment, isn't it? We spent all this time talking about human intent, revenue, ethics, regulation.
And then you see that.
And then you see that primal interaction. Natural predation, natural defense, all playing out in this raw life or death struggle. It puts all our discussions about quotas and conservation into the bigger, more relentless context of nature's reality.
So we started this deep dive with Zimbabwean economics hanging on elephant permits. We swung through the Grand Canyon needing volunteer bison collars, noted the alleged mess up of a Liechtenstein prince,
celebrated the loyalty of hunting dogs,
and absorbed a critical safety lesson from a 50 cal failure. That is a serious spectrum of information.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what these sources really confirm is that the definition of modern hunting is just constantly shifting.
Mm-hmm.
It exists at the same time as a crucial, necessary tool for wildlife management, often demanding that hunter expertise and labor, and as this fragile, high-stakes source of national revenue, especially in places that are financially vulnerable.
And the decisions made by one person, whether it's a prince or a volunteer, can have global consequences for how it's all perceived.
For perception and for policy.
Yeah. So what does this all mean?
I think it means the individual hunter is now fully baked into the global conservation structure. The reliance on hunting for both that specialized labor, like the bison call, and for financial sustainability, like the elephant quotas, it makes the hunter an irreplaceable part of wildlife management, whether they realize it or not.
So, considering all the sources we talked about, the need for voluntary hunters in conservation alongside that financial dependence on revenue from hunting, it makes you think about the modern social contract, doesn't it?
It really does.
Does this increasing reliance on the hunter for both conservation and for revenue change the very definition of what ethical hunting means today? What responsibility does the individual hunter now carry for global wildlife management just by choosing to participate?
That's the question.
We'll leave you with that thought.